Senator Stevens has been my friend for 45-odd years, and I knew him many, many years ago before he ever got down here, so he's my friend.
Alaska's congressional delegation reacts to Stevens' indictment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 30th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Palin prepares for the investigation into her firing of Walt Monagan.
So speculation even erupted over this in the last 2 weeks. We have been ready, willing, and able to speak to any aspect of this issue.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
One day after being indicted for lying, Senator Ted Stevens was back at work serving as Alaska's senior senator. He cast votes on the floor and attended a committee meeting today, followed through the halls of the U.S. Capitol building by throngs of reporters. Tomorrow afternoon, Stevens will be arraigned in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. He'll have to enter a plea in response to the charges, 7 counts of making false statements about gifts he allegedly received from oil services company Vico. The Department of Justice says the gifts totaled more than $250,000 and included major renovations to Stevens' Girdwood home. While the senator hasn't been indicted for bribery, the charges do allege that he did favors for Vico while he was taking the gifts. Stevens' colleague, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, says the indictment isn't interfering with Stevens' ability to do his job.
It was a terrible day yesterday. Senator Stevens was here at work today, voting on the Senate floor, doing the work that needed to be done here in the Senate and for his constituents. So I don't believe that we're going to see a change, or anything noticeable to Alaskans because of this.
Yesterday, within hours of the indictment, Stevens stepped down from his leadership positions on committees as required by Republican Senate rules. He gave up his leadership posts on the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee and the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. But he's still sitting on the committees as a regular member, and Senator Murkowski says he'll still have power and an important voice.
Take, for example, the Defense Subcommittee that he has either chaired or co-chaired with Senator Inouye from Hawaii for decades. That relationship has not changed, even though Senator Stevens will not be that co-chair. Those two gentlemen have as strong a bond as any two senators in the United States Senate. I don't see that changing at all.
Alaska's Congressman Don Young had a simple message today about Stevens.
Senator Stevens is my friend, and that's where, as far as I'm going. He's my friend. And Senator Stevens has been my friend for 45-odd years, and I knew him many, many years ago before he ever got down here, so he's my friend.
Stevens says he is innocent and that he plans to fight the charges. He's represented Alaska in Washington since 1968 and is the longest-serving senator in Republican Party history. Preparation is nearly complete for the legislative investigation into the events surrounding the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monagan and whether there was any abuse of power leading up to his dismissal. Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French says he anticipates choosing and hiring a field investigator later this week. French says the investigation will be thorough, with the committee having the power to subpoena testimony if needed. He says lawmakers want an investigator who will be able to get to the truth on the subject.
As that investigator works through the interview process, you may find individuals who are just reluctant to speak on the record without the force of law, and that is a subpoena, to compel that testimony out of fear for their job or fear for offending a colleague or fear for saying something that denigrates the governor. They'll just be reluctant, and that's what the power of subpoena will help ease, if you will, is to get that person in front of a committee under oath, and then it's more like a courtroom than it is an investigation or an interview happening on the street.
French says the subpoena power cannot be delegated. Anyone unwilling to talk to the investigator will face the possibility of testifying in front of the full committee. Governor Palin says she welcomes the investigation. Responding to reporters yesterday, she said she does not foresee the need for subpoenas to get information from her or her staff.
Since speculation even erupted over this in the last 2 weeks, we have been ready, willing, and able to speak to any aspect of this issue.
Would you expect any of your executive staff are going to need to be subpoenaed to testify?
I doubt that there would be a need for subpoena, no, because, again, with nothing to hide, I would anticipate that anyone around me would be ready, willing, and able to speak also, as I am.
The authority to hire an investigator comes with the request that a report be returned as quickly as possible. Flood warnings are in effect across the eastern interior until tomorrow afternoon. Heavy rains have swollen rivers over their banks. High water is threatening homes and roads in areas of Fairbanks and Sulcha. North Star Borough Emergency Operations spokeswoman Sally Stuvik says the water from the Sulcha and Tanana Rivers is overflowing into Sulcha subdivisions.
We're estimating that there's between 100 and 150 residences in that area that are impacted by the flooding. Red Cross has opened an evacuation shelter, which is located at the Sulcha Elementary School, and currently there are six people in the area utilizing that shelter. We are aware that 44 people have voluntarily evacuated the area.
Stuvek says the water is still coming up. The Tanana and Sulcha rivers are expected to crest well above flood stage tomorrow around midnight. Stuvek says the Tanana has also flooded the Rosie Creek Chena Pump area of southwest Fairbanks. She says several residential area roads have been covered or damaged.
We have had several calls of people saying, you know, that the water is, you know, rising into where their homes are.
Stuvek says emergency responders have assisted a few people, while a number of others have gotten out on their own. She says an evacuation center is set up at a local elementary school, but that evacuees have been picked up by family and friends. The wet weather has forced the Alaska Railroad Corporation to shut down train activity north of Denali Park. The tracks aren't flooded yet, but the railroad is worried that could happen as water levels continue to rise. The heavy rain has caused damage to roads as far south as Paxson. Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says water damage to the Richardson Highway was repaired as of late yesterday.
The hole that was at mile 233, which is by the Bear Creek Bridge, that was filled up and the road was returned to two lanes of traffic. They also had to fix some slides, and there's also a hole at mile 299 of the Richardson, and that's also being repaired.
Bailey says 11 straight days of rain along the Taylor Highway have resulted in very muddy conditions, and drivers are advised to exercise caution. July and August are Fairbanks' wettest months, but National Weather Service meteorologist Mike Richman says current conditions are unusual.
These are large-scale frontal systems coming from low-pressure systems that are moving in a very fast jet stream flow, which we don't often see that in the summer, at least not in July.
Richman says the current trend is more typical of September. There was a break in the heavy precipitation, but more rain is in the forecast. Fairbanks has picked up more than 3 inches of rain since Monday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a massive caribou kill in Point Hope upsets local residents.
Our elders are hurt, and elders can't take that kind of stuff. They get sick from those kinds of deep worries.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Residents of the Chukchi Sea coastal community of Point Hope in northwest Alaska are expressing shock over the massive killing of caribou on the Arctic tundra about 25 miles inland east of the Inupiaq village. State troopers say the killing left a lot of wasted meat. Division of Wildlife Enforcement Trooper Eric Loring says they first visited the site 10 days ago to inspect the kill sites after a resident of Point Hope called in a complaint. Loring says weather kept them from getting to the area for about 4 days after they were notified.
We're right now with predation and factors of the time frame that we're looking at, a lot of decomposition and everything like that. We're estimating the total of 120 caribou that we have found to be killed, but 60 to 70 of those we can show some level of waste.
Loring wouldn't specify what caliber rifle was used, but said several different types of rounds were found. Loring says troopers are hopeful that Point Hope residents will do their own investigation and assist law enforcement. But he says the interaction with community members hasn't been easy.
We're getting a little bit of resistance, but we've had some helpful individuals within the village and some not so helpful individuals.
Native Village of Point Hope President Jack Schaefer says residents were stunned by the events.
Yeah, they're outraged. We're poor people. Food comes first. You know, there's no way in our minds that we would waste food if we have an empty freezer.
Schaefer says there has been tension and apparent miscommunication between village residents and state troopers. He says residents have been unfairly characterized as non-cooperative.
We were told to keep quiet. We were told it was going to be private and that they couldn't communicate with us until the investigation was done. How are we supposed to know if they don't tell us?
Schaefer says this sort of waste has never occurred before because villagers are taught to take only what is needed for subsistence.
We're real worried. Our elders are hurt, and elders can't take that kind of stuff. They get sick from those kinds of deep worries.
Schaefer says the tribal council will impose punishment if any tribal members are found to be responsible. He says a value on the meat would most likely be assigned and community service sentences would be given to what he says would be first-time offenders. Native Village of Point Hope Executive Director Lily Tizrulik says experienced hunters will be making a trip to the site tomorrow to do their own assessment of how many animals were killed and what may have been wasted. She says they want to be sure sick animals were not part of the calculation.
And once they're shot, the hunter finds that the meat is just not good. It's just not good. So we're thinking that that might be a factor.
Tizrulik says they've had little information from troopers about the nature of their investigation, saying they had a meeting that focused mainly on information about hunting licenses.
So we really haven't gotten any official information from the troopers about who's being investigated or what kind of facts that they have at this point. But definitely, it's created an awareness for our tribal members, for our tribal organizations. We definitely are going to implement some ordinances at our next regular council meeting.
Tizrulik says the Point Hope tribe owns 100,000 acres and they will strengthen their own mandates on hunting regulations for tribal members. Andrew Peterson with the Alaska Attorney General's Office of Special Prosecution says if there are any charges, they would amount to wanton waste, which has a mandatory minimum of 7 days in jail, a $2,500 fine, and a 5-year loss of hunting privileges. Another charge could be failure to salvage, which has no minimum charge, but maximums of 1 year in jail and a $10,000 fine. Troopers are asking for anyone who may have seen airplanes or hunters in the kill area between the 3rd and 11th of July to call them with the information. King salmon on the Kuskokwim River are not meeting escapement goals. Despite a great fish season of fishing, Alaska Fish and Game says only a fraction of kings are making it to their spawning grounds. Local residents and area biologists are wondering if high energy prices are to blame. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
All season long, the Kuskokwim king run looked great. Subsistence fishers reported catching plenty of kings and big ones, too. At the same time, state biologists sampling the river recorded healthy numbers around the Bethel area, located at the lower end of the river. Given the early figures, Alaska Fish and Game expected to see kings reach Kuskokwim tributary rivers in large quantities. Biologist Doug Molyneau.
You'd think we probably would do pretty good with escapement based on how the Bethel test fish played out there. But that's not how the story has been unfolding.
Escapement on the Guithluk River is now on par to be the second lowest in recorded history, and the same could be said about the Tuluksac River. Of all the watersheds Fish and Game monitors, only the upper Holitna is likely to meet escapement goals this year. Molyneau said the results are puzzling.
Seem to be missing fish. Where might those fish be missing from?
Molyneau presented that question to the Kuskokwim Salmon Working Group. The group consists of representatives from up and down the river, along with commercial and sport reps as well. The group makes management recommendations for Fish and Game. Molyneux listed several factors that could play a part in the disappointing numbers, but he emphasized that the actual cause is yet unknown. The run was late, and the water is colder than usual. Temperatures in the Kuskokwim have been on the low side all summer, but lately they've been near historical lows. But Bethel test fishery numbers show that almost all the kings have already passed through the Kuskokwim, and while cold water does slow gonad development and can push back spawning, Molyneux says that would not account for such a rapid drop-off.
Yes, the run was late. Yes, there's still some king salmon coming in, but do we expect it to rise very much above that 2,000 line? Probably not.
Molyneux told the working group he suspects many of the kings ended up on fish racks along the river. Before detailing the numbers, he questioned representatives about how subsistence harvests compared to previous years. Tuntutuliak is located on the Kuskokwim Bay. From there, Henry Lupi says people have been making an extra effort to put fish away.
Same thing with me. I'm putting away a lot more fish than years before.
A little farther upriver, Mike Williams Sr. of Akiak says as fuel prices go up in his village, more fish goes up too.
Our dependence on the subsistence fish is very, very important. More important than ever before.
And much farther upriver in the tiny village of Crooked Creek, where gas is selling for $7.30 a gallon, Evelyn Thomas says people are trying to fill up their freezers.
You know, the cost of fuel goes up as it comes up the river, so yes, there are more people taking more fish.
There is just one local store in Crooked Creek, and they must have their supplies barged up before freeze-up. As high fuel prices have pushed up freight charges, Thomas says the local store may not be able to buy as much food this year.
We know we're going to have a tough winter.
Thomas says that subsistence fishers will be going after silver salmon in a big way this year. That's unusual. Also known as cohos, that run arrives later in the season and is typically exploited for commercial use. But high fuel prices are affecting that fishery as well. Typically, there are two processors that come out for the coho run, but only one has shown up so far. That's Coastal Villages Seafood. Their fisheries manager, Joe Hall, said without the other company in town, the overall processing capacity has already been limited.
Normally, there's two buyers in Bethel. There's four cranes running. We had two cranes running since we were the only buyer, and pretty much similar amount of permits.
Hall says that means they will have to reduce the numbers that those commercial permit holders can bring into their docks and tenders.
Once we do open the river, we need to go with a 3-day-a-week instead of a 4-day-a-week.
Hall is also recommending reducing the commercial openings from 6 hours down to 3. While commercial numbers are easier for Fish and Game to calculate, subsistence numbers are gathered from surveys. Those surveys won't be completed until later this year, and that's when the department will have a better understanding of where all the Kuskokwim kings went this year. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com. And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Regulation of Alaska's cruise industry could be headed to court. Clean water activists have taken steps that could lead to legal action against ships they claim are not providing enough information about ocean discharges. The industry says it's working hard to make its discharges safe, but it's also threatening to challenge state requirements it says may be unreasonable. The conflict could end up before the legislature. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The conflict is based on terms of the cruise ship initiative. Voters passed the tax and pollution control measure in August of 2006. It requires cruise lines to obtain permits to release certain materials, including metals such as copper, into state waters. The lines must also describe how discharges will be reduced to meet more stringent standards that take effect in 2 years. Gershon Cohen of the Earth Island Institute says the ships are not meeting those requirements. He also says the state is taking too easy a stand when issuing the permits.
We're asking the state to
to either force them to comply and turn in a source reduction evaluation that is not a slap in the face to the agency, in terms of what they ask them to do before applying, or find them to be criminally negligent and pull their permits.
The Institute and the group responsible cruising in Alaska, which both backed the initiative, have given notice that they will sue unless the state takes a stronger stand. State officials have already asked for additional details from the cruise lines. Denise Koch of the Department of Environmental Conservation says its cruise ship program has already issued a mid-August deadline.
We need more information from them, especially in regards to what they're doing in terms of investigating new technologies or optimizing their current wastewater technologies to make sure that they're actually moving towards compliance with these 2010 limits.
She says the state could pull some permits if the lines do not comply. The Alaska Cruise Association says its members will provide what's needed by the deadline. Spokesman John Binkley says some back and forth over discharge permit information is to be expected, and he says initiative backers' protests are publicity stunts. The association has made its own complaints about the discharge permit details. It's given formal notice that it may challenge the rules, especially for metals such as copper, but it's asked to wait before it makes its protests official. The Department of Environmental Conservation just granted a delay. Binkley says it's best for the state as well as the industry.
That really saves, I think, the state and all the parties time and money and effort to see what we can do in the next year to improve and to identify the sources of some of these metals and hopefully reduce them.
State officials say the delay makes no changes to current or future wastewater discharge limits. It gives the industry until June 1st to decide what to do. Another part of the initiative required ships to host state-paid environmental staffers called Ocean Rangers. A report issued in June showed that 10 of 28 vessels carrying rangers limited their access to some systems or staff. Koch of the state's cruise ship program says the problems have been largely cleared up. A formal report from Crowley Marine, which is managing the program, is due out soon. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Galena City Council has reaffirmed its support for the continued study of nuclear power for the community, but Galena officials are still looking for money to pay for the next phase of that investigation. The Alaska Energy Authority will likely be investing in a variety of alternative energy technologies over the next few years, but as of now, nuclear power isn't one of them. From KIYU in Galena, Tim Bedoni reports.
While Toshiba, the manufacturer of the 10-megawatt nuclear plant being proposed for Galena, is holding regular meetings with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in preparation for a license application next year, the city of Galena and its partners on the nuclear proposal have not made much progress on their side of the licensing process for almost 2 years. The state laws concerning nuclear power stipulate that the Alaska Energy Authority cannot study or be involved with nuclear power. Statutes also stipulate that nuclear power cannot be defined as an alternative energy source. Added together, the laws could exclude nuclear power projects from receiving any of the expected windfall of alternative and renewable energy funding coming from the state. Galena Nuclear Project consultant and former city manager Marvin Yoder says that those laws are definitely roadblocks, but he and other project leaders have already found ways around them.
Last money we got was state money that came through the Department of Commerce to avoid that problem. We do want to deal with that, and in fact, have been trying to deal with it. Speaker Harris actually asked the legal people in Juneau to do a complete search of all statutes to deal with it, and we have some ideas of other things, but there are a few things that we think that the next legislature may have to deal with if small-scale nuclear is going to be allowed in the state of Alaska on a more broad basis.
Using a $500,000 state grant, the city of Galena commissioned a series of white papers in 2006, which outlined the major issues that nuclear regulators would scrutinize, such as emergency planning, earthquake dangers, and decommissioning. Removing the anti-nuclear clauses in state law, Yoder explains, would require a bill to be passed by the legislature and be signed by the governor, and no such bill has been introduced yet. Getting federal money to pay for the next round of environmental and financial studies, Yoder predicts, would have a better chance for success. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission requires several years' worth of specific weather data at the proposed site of a new reactor and Galena officials and lobbyists have been unable to secure about $2 million for that and other pre-application studies. But Yoder predicts that the money might be easier to get now that Toshiba has made its intentions clear.
The real issue, I think, at the federal level, when we talked to them, was that they had to see more progress from Toshiba. They were not willing to fund us before they actually saw a viable project from Toshiba. So now that Toshiba has definitely set a schedule as to when they're going to apply for their permit, that makes the project that much more real.
Toshiba and its American subsidiary, Westinghouse Electric, plan to submit technical documents to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for review and comment through the end of 2008, and then turn in an application for the approval of its 4S reactor design sometime in 2009. That review process could take 2 years or more. And with a 4-1 vote, the Galena City Council reaffirmed its support for the investigation of nuclear power at its July meeting, the third time the council has passed such a resolution since December of 2004. Galena's state and federal lobbyists have asked the council to rank its alternative energy priorities recently, after city officials showed a willingness to embrace coal bed methane development, in-river hydropower, and biomass energy projects. Council member and Galena Vice Mayor Tom Johnson said during the meeting that if Galena officials truly believe that the 4S nuclear power plant is the best long-term energy option that's currently on the table, then they need to make that very clear.
I really believe that this thing is coming to a turning point because Toshiba finally got off the dime. I mean, we waited on Toshiba for 2 years to get to the NRC. But now that they have done that, it's important for somebody to say, I have a site, and to try and put together a firm to do the combined operating license, to be the owner of the plant, to be the operator of the plant, and to get the first one going.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission recently instituted a three-part process for permitting nuclear power plants, in which a manufacturer seeks a permit for a design, an owner and operator seeks a permit for a site that could host a nuclear reactor, and then the two tracks converge in the application for a combined operating license. At one point, the NRC claimed it could completely evaluate a combined operating license in 3 to 4 years. But with 9 applications for nuclear projects currently on its docket, and about a dozen more expected by the end of next year, NRC officials admit that the review process could take longer. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Dave Waldron and Gooseberry Peter are our audio engineers. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster, our managing editor is Duncan Moon, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com. Leading a nonprofit organization or tribal government is challenging. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program provides nonprofit CEOs and tribal administrators with paid time off to reflect on their work, renew their personal energy, and avoid professional burnout. You can apply or nominate someone you know at rasmussen.org or call toll-free 877-366-2700 for an application. Application deadline is October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.